Welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Kara James, the Foundation's Senior Policy Analyst on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare. Today's Topics is a series of conversations that address issues relating to health and healthcare disparities in the U.S. Today's topic, Is the Healthcare System Ready for Health Reform?, comes at a time when Congress and the President have made health reform a national priority, and Congress has before it several proposals to expand coverage to many of the 46 million people who are uninsured. Proposed changes to Medicaid alone could mean as many as 15 million people would become eligible for the program, which leads one to ask, is the healthcare system ready for the influx? Our conversation today will discuss provisions in the bills that address the need for increasing the healthcare workforce and maintaining the safety net, as well as potential gaps in the legislation. We will also address how health reform could improve or exacerbate the existing issues that people living in medically underserved areas face. We welcome your questions, so feel free to email us. The address is ask@kff.org. Our panel today includes three distinguished guests whose bios are available on our website. In our studio, we have Dr. Lewis Sullivan, President Emeritus of Morehouse School of Medicine and the former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Next to him is Alan Weil, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy and President of the Center for Health Policy Development. And last but not least, Dr. Candace Chen, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in the Department of Health Policy at the George Washington University. I want to thank you all for joining us. Dr. Sullivan, I'd like to start with you. If you could tell us, what is the current workforce situation today?
We have in the United States really a relatively unrecognized shortage of health professionals, and it really is going to get worse if we don't do something about it. And what I mean by that is this. 2 years ago, the Association of American Medical Colleges urged a 30% expansion in the number of medical students admitted every year to avoid a shortage. We've seen some responses with enlarging class sizes, but far from a 30% increase. We already have a nursing shortage that has existed for as far back as 10 years. And by the year 2020, at the current rates of training, we'll have more than a million, we'll be more than a million short of the needed nurses. We're short of pharmacists by at least 150,000 pharmacists who are needed. And in the other fields as well. So we really are already on the cusp of a severe shortage of health professionals. With the enactment of health manpower legislation, this is going to increase the demand for health professionals. So health reform must also address the need for more health professionals. We've seen the situation in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was successful in passing legislation to see that every, 98% of the people in Massachusetts now have health insurance. But in some communities in Massachusetts now, people have to wait weeks to get an appointment to see a physician because of the pent-up demand that has been unleashed. So we really have to address manpower issues.
And this is, you know, on top of whether or not we pass health reform, correct?
Oh, yes. We really do need more manpower now. Many hospitals will tell you they have difficulty staffing their nursing programs. We also are importing from abroad every year large numbers of health professionals. Within medicine, for example, we graduate some 16,000 doctors every year from all of the nation's medical schools. But in our first-year residency programs, we have between 21 and 22,000 doctors who are starting residency training. So that means means that we have 5 or 6,000 physicians every year who did not receive their training here in the United States, starting their postgraduate residency training. So, and we're importing nurses from places such as the Philippines, from places in Asia, Africa, South America, and that's causing a problem in some of those countries who already have their shortages and who are really concerned about the United States and other Western countries really draining them of needed manpower. So, yes, we really have a significant manpower issue.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Chen, is this just a shortage issue or is there a distribution issue as well?
I think that's what's so complicating about the workforce issue is it's not just numbers and overall numbers. It is about distribution. And when we say distribution, when we talk physicians, when we talk nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, we're talking about specialty distribution. And we're seeing some of our greatest shortages in primary care. And the other distribution issue is geographic distribution. How do we get providers to go into areas that they typically haven't gone into? And how do we solve that rural underserved problem? And when you start looking at things like the Massachusetts example is a great example. And one of the what made the New York Times was the fact that people couldn't get in to see primary care doctors. Suddenly they had coverage, but coverage doesn't equal access. When we look at our community health centers, right now they face a shortage compared to U.S. benchmarks of over 1,800 primary care providers, and nurses is a little bit under that. And if they are going to increase the services that they provide and reach a goal, they have a goal of 30 million, which is would about double their patient population, they're going to need something like 15,000 more primary care providers in the next 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And so, Ellen, are there any things that states are doing to, you know, deal with this issue, and how are they going about it?
This is an issue high on the agenda for states. Part of the challenge is it has a long pipeline, and sometimes the political process is oriented more towards short-term solutions. A lot of states are looking at their training programs, their medical schools, their nursing schools, looking at capacity, looking at residency slots, loan repayment, and other financial incentives for people to either go in certain directions or practice in certain areas. They're slow to change, but there is increased discussion about scope of practice. A part of the shortage is that we've defined who can perform which tasks, and sometimes over time with automation and other kinds of technical assistance, it's possible for what used to be a more complex task to be done with less training. And so there are states that are starting to ask, do we really need to create these barriers? Maybe we'd have more personnel. Should say that a lot of the personnel shortages are also at a level of training significantly below the doctor and the nurse, and we're staffing nursing homes and other kinds of staff who don't have the same level of training. Health information technology and telehealth, telemedicine, those kinds of terms, trying to take advantage of using physicians in one part of the state to oversee and interact with patients elsewhere. And the health information technology as a data infrastructure just to improve the quality of care, again, so that someone who's treating someone on site has access to information. So there's a great deal of discussion about this issue at the mm-hmm. state level.
I wonder if I might just sure. add one point here, too. I agree with all of that, because we do need to help redefine the scope of practice of all kinds of health professionals, because physicians don't have to do everything. There are many things that other health professionals with less training can do just as well, if not even better, than physicians. But on the broader issue of numbers, one of the things I would point out is this. Between 1956 and 1981, we had a massive increase in training programs for doctors and other health professionals. We increased the number of medical schools from 80 that existed in 1950 to 127 by 1981. That was the result of a massive federal program supporting expansion in medical education. We were training 8,000 doctors every year before the mid-1950s. That reached 16,000, almost 17,000 by 1981. But that's when it stopped. The last new medical school that opened in the United States in the 20th century was in 1981, when two schools, Mercer University in Macon, Georgia, and Charles Drew Medical School in Los Angeles, opened. Now, in the beginning of the 21st century, we see a few new medical schools opening, but they are not the result of federal leadership. They are state initiatives. We're seeing new medical schools open in Florida. We have activities in Texas and California and in Virginia. A new private school is scheduled to open on Long Island and in New York. So the striking thing is that the federal government is missing in action here. I think that's a serious mistake, because health professionals are mobile. We need to look upon this as a national issue and not simply a state issue. States need to play a role, and states did play a role in the expansion that existed between 1956 and 1981. But the Department of Health and Human Services provided a lot of the leadership and the funding. Even the Defense Department supported the development of new medical schools and the Veterans Administration. I think there were 7 or 8 schools that were opened primarily with VA support. That kind of vigorous federal leadership is missing today. That needs to be part of the whole issue.
So you guys have touched on, I think, just about every topic we're going to cover in this conversation, if time allows us. But I want to go back, Dr. Sullivan, you just opened a perfect segue into the federal government. And, you know, Congress has before it several bills that are, you know, largely addressing health reform through a coverage perspective. What in the bills address the workforce issues?
Well, there are a number of things that are in the bill that certainly are welcome, and I think they are important, such as funds to expand community health centers, primary health care programs, Title VII program, which was a $300 million program that was unfortunately reduced by half in the last few years, putting pressure on physicians, nurses, community health centers, and this is where primary care is most needed. Everyone agrees central to a well-functioning healthcare system is primary care, adequate number of providers, doctors, nurses, dentists, and other health professionals. Now, some of those funds are being restored, but we need to do a lot more. Another aspect of the manpower issue is diversity of our workforce. We are undergoing, as a nation, a tremendous rapid transformation in the demography of our population. By the year 2042, the U.S. Census Bureau says we will no longer have a white majority population. Today, one-third of our citizens are either African-American, Hispanic-American, or Native American. When we look at our health professions, we see perhaps 9% of our nurses are either African-American, Hispanic-American, or Native American, 6% of doctors, and 5% of dentists. So there's a disconnect between the racial and ethnic makeup of our health professions workforce and our population. The reason this is important is this. The health professions are science-based professions, but they're practiced in a social setting, meaning effective communication, understanding of the patient's culture, language, value systems, the ability to communicate effectively and develop trust so that compliance will be good. All of those things are important. So as we really undergo this demographic shift, we not only need to look at numbers, but also the composition of our health workforce if we are going to be effective in addressing the needs of our citizens.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Chen, are there other things in the bills that will address the workforce issues?
I think that was a great summary. I think there are two more places that that are specifically addressing the workforce, and one is the graduate medical education issue. If you are talking about federal government investment in medical education, really the biggest investment has been from the Medicare GME, putting about $9 billion into graduate medical education a year, and there's problems with that system. The problem is that it's highly tied to hospitals, and there's very little accountability, and so essentially what we're getting is a graduate is a product, a workforce, a physician workforce that is very ready to staff the hospitals of the country, but not very ready to provide the primary care that the country needs. And some of the provisions that we're seeing in on both sides is a redistribution of the unused graduate medical education slots. So there's a cap on the current number, but there's provisions to redistribute those slots primarily towards primary care positions. But another extremely promising provision is the teaching health centers, which would actually direct some of the graduate medical education funding to health centers to be able to run and to set the mission of those residency programs. And if you can move those residency programs, while they'll still need to do, of course, inpatient training, if you can move the mission into the health centers and into that community-based primary care setting where residents can become trained in patient-centered medical homes, they can be trained in multidisciplinary teams, then you're really going to get the product that you actually want out of that graduate medical education system. And then the other thing I would say is is provisions to do more in terms of planning, both at the national level in terms of a national healthcare workforce commission or potentially advisory council, and then also analysis. And HRSA probably is the organization that has done the most analysis. When you look at the funding levels that they've received to do that in the last couple of years, they've pretty much been zeroed out. And so that would make a huge step in terms of both planning and having the data to be able to plan with.
Mm-hmm. If I could just add, these are great enumerations of sort of the supply side, but there's a whole demand side that's also out there, which mm-hmm. is to try to figure out how to pay more for services that are tied to primary care, mm-hmm. with then increasing the number of people who would be interested in moving into that career. And other countries, when they've faced this kind of shortage in more centralized control systems, they can sort of radically change the salaries. Britain did that, and they, you know, on a dime, they just said, we need more primary care physicians, so we're going to increase their salaries. We don't have that kind of centralization, but whether it's payment models that are around the primary care medical home model, whether it's accountable care organizations that are accountable for a population and outcomes, and if you look at the care models, you expect, as we know from the existing sort of examples of them, that they tend to hire more primary care and have more of a primary care orientation. Some of the population health outreach and financing activities all, I think, have an opportunity not just to help us sort of find and identify, but also to make it more financially rewarding.
That's a great point that I wanted to get into a little bit when we're talking about medically underserved areas and, you know, sort of rural areas that are really struggling to have an adequate number of providers. And we're talking about payments. You'd mentioned earlier, Dr. Chen, that it's not just a numbers issues. We have a distribution issues. So what in the bills are trying to deal with that? And is it simply a matter of if we pay doctors more, they're going to go into these areas and treat these patients?
Well, let me begin with that. I think we have to have better support systems for not only doctors, but nurses and others, where they can be supported with telemedicine, for example, because any health professional really is helped by communication with colleagues. This is what happens in large medical centers, where doctors, nurses, and other health professionals really benefit from exchanging ideas, information, et cetera. Out in rural settings or settings that are isolated, that's been one of the problems. There's not the support system there. So what we can do through telemedicine and other mechanisms to support those health professionals, I think, is important. The other thing I would comment on is this. While, indeed, I agree that we need to pay more for primary care services, I would point out that doesn't necessarily mean that we would have a more expensive system, because if you have primary care available, then you can avoid complicated illness downstream and really can not only have a better health outcome, but also save dollars there. So we really need to spend our dollars more wisely. But we have made a mistake, I believe, in our country by not paying enough for primary care services. And we have, at the same time, put the burden of financing a health profession's education entirely on the student. It wasn't always that way. Prior to the mid-1970s, there were abundant scholarships available so that students could really get a health profession's education and not end up in such heavy debt. But we stopped those programs in the mid-70s, the theory being that health professionals are high-paid specialties, so they should finance their education out of future earnings. Therefore, student loan programs developed. And so today, with students graduating with the debts in excess of $100,000, sometimes even $200,000, we've set up a system that drives students, or young health professionals, into high-paying specialties, away from the less high-paying fields, such as primary care. That is a systemic error, in my view, that we have driven individuals toward. So lack of support in rural areas, isolated areas, works against primary care. a reimbursement system that is wrong, a system whereby students finance their education, that is wrong also. So there are these systemic issues that we need to address. They haven't gotten the attention they need.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go into medical education, but I want to stick with the sort of payments issue here for a little bit for longer. And, you know, well, what are the other issues? So we have a support system, but what else is driving the shortages, particularly in some of the medical underserved areas?
Well, I think it's clear from all of these comments, this is a combination of supply and demand. It's both the practice environment and context as well as the payment on the back end, and that you really need all of them. I mean, part of what makes it hard for some of the distribution issues now is large numbers of uninsured and large portions of the population that are covered by Medicaid and Medicare, and Medicaid is often a low payer. Medicare in some instances is as well. And so making a practice financially viable in the wake of the debt, but even without that, would be very challenging. And we're probably skipping ahead to further down in the agenda. But, you know, if you took tens of millions of Americans who are in many instances geographically concentrated, they're certainly not distributed equally around the country, and gave a payment source for them to receive services, by itself, that's a big help. But it's only a help. It's only a help because it's only the money, and it doesn't affect these other practice issues and quality of life issues. We can expect continued pressure on payment levels associated with these programs. Witness the current debate over whether a public plan should be paying providers at the same rates as Medicare. So it's not as if somehow this becomes a lucrative line of work, but it certainly changes the dynamics.
If I can add another dimension to this as well, and I'm pleased that there's some attention being given to this in the health reform issue, and that is health promotion, disease prevention activities. Health reform needs to be about more than taking care of sick people. It has to be about keeping us well. And this is an issue that having the best trained professionals, the best functioning system, if you have a population where the health behavior is dysfunctional, you're going to continue to have problems, including high costs. And a good example of that right now is the fact that we have the greatest incidence of obesity we've ever had as a population, where 2/3 of our population is overweight and 1/3 is obese. Along with that, we have such things as increased diabetes, heart disease, stroke, etc. So this is tied to our lifestyle. The diets we consume, our lifestyles are different. We have crowded physical education out of our schools. We have our youngsters and our adults as well sitting in front of television screens or computer screens rather than out playing ball, etc. So we really have to change the health behavior of our population as well to really emphasize prevention and healthy behavior in addition to working to address the healthcare system.
So, Dr. Chin, I want to turn to you for a second because, you know, we're talking about sort of these training issues. And Dr. Sullivan mentioned, you know, diversity among the workforce. And we've had conversation about not just the physicians, but we're talking nurses and we're talking pharmacists and things like that. What is happening with regards to medical education to both increase the number, the diversity, as well as sort of the allied health professions across the board? And I know that's a lot of questions. I think it was a triple-barreled one, but
I think the very promising thing is some of those Title VII programs that Dr. Sullivan was talking about are getting reinvested in, and they're being expanded to include things like interdisciplinary training. In the House side, I believe, there are innovations in interdisciplinary training grants built into Title VII programs. There are training programs for dentistry, for physician's assistants. The Title VIII is typically the nursing. And so in that sense, it's very promising that there is renewed interest and renewed investment in these programs. I would like to take a step back, though, and talking about how to get doctors or any healthcare provider really into the more rural and underserved areas. And I agree, it is a payment issue. It is a practice issue and setting up practices in ways that people will want to practice in them. But the other issue and the thing that at least medical students will tell you, and you know, I'll tell you as a relatively young physician, is that lifestyle matters. And what that means to me is that if we want our graduates to go back into these communities, one of the things we need to do is we need to recruit from those communities so that when they go back, they're much more likely to go back because they have the social networks that would support them outside of practice. And one very disturbing statistic in medical education is the fact that something like 60% of our medical students come from the top 20% of socioeconomic position. And so we haven't done a good job in terms of pipeline programs and recruitment. And a promising thing is the reinvestment in the diversity programs, in the programs for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, specifically in the Senate Finance. There's a component focused on that.
And so, if I could just add to that, I agree fully with that, because, I'm old enough to have been among the students. When I went to medical school, money was not an issue. Dollars were not an issue. I graduated owing $500 to the Student Financial Aid Office. But that was because there were scholarships available at the time. And I think we have set up a system where now, indeed, people really from low-income families are discouraged from pursuing a health professions career because of the threat of a high debt burden. $100,000 debt or $200,000 debt to a student coming from a family earning $30,000 or $40,000, when they may be one of three or four students, that doesn't make any sense to that student. So it seems irresponsible to students from a background like that to pursue a career where they will end up owing such large debts. That's why we have to change that as a systemic problem. We have to look upon investment in young people as an investment in our society and find ways that they can pursue a health professions career without such an overhang of tremendous debt.
So before we sort of move from the workforce piece, we've talked a lot about what's in there in terms of the redistribution of the GME, and we have the residency and the loan payments, and we have the teaching health centers. So there's a lot of positive things that are in the bill. What's missing? And how well do we think these pieces will work as far as increasing the workforce? And I think one of the issues particularly that I'm interested in is these training programs take time. We have implementation that will be happening in the next couple of years, and there will be a lag between the time in which people actually get their insurance card and the training programs see fruit on the tree from people who are in these programs. So what's missing and what more do we need to do?
Well, I would say this, which is really not part of the legislation now, and I know this would cause a lot of questions in view of the economic situation we are in, but I believe we need to find ways that students can get a health professions education without such substantial debt. You know, we're not going to get poor students pursuing these careers, although they may be bright, they may be motivated, but also they have to find a way that they can support their educational pipeline. We had scholarships when back in the 60s and the 70s, the early 70s. I think we have to look upon scholarships availability as a way of investing in the future of our society. I think the sentiment when scholarships were done away with was that these students can finance their own education. Well, that is putting it all on the individual. If we are really going to help see that the health professions are populated by people from all strata in our society, we have to find support for them, and it really means scholarships. I know that we may not be able to do that this year, but I think that has become part of the discussion and part of the commitment. Otherwise, we're going to have an increasingly stratified society. To me, that is bad. That is really the nidus for social instability in the long run, as well as continued problems in getting people going into low-income communities, because I certainly agree with the idea, if you recruit from those communities where people understand the community, they are committed to the community, they're much more likely to go into back into those communities.
I'm going to take a page from Alan, and I think the big thing that's missing is the payment reform, particularly when you start talking about primary care payments. There are things like primary care bonus payments, but and they're generally 5 or 10%. And when you look at what that actually means for a primary care physician, an analysis done by the Robert Graham Center showed that a 5% primary care bonus, given the fact that it'll only be on Medicare, and that doesn't make up the entirety of most physicians' practices, and it will only count for certain services, would mean about a $2,000 increase annually. And when you're looking at income disparities between primary care and specialties of over $200,000 a year, $2,000 doesn't sound like very much. It is an important message to send. But the reality of it is probably not enough to make that big difference. And not to get too far into the payment issues, but reforming the sustainable growth rate has essentially fallen out of both sides of the healthcare reform bills.
And if you had, you know, the pen for an hour to slip in something to the bills?
Well, this is not my core expertise, so I think it's best to leave the heavy thinking to my colleagues here. I do think the next iteration of payment is not just increasing at the margin for some number of providers, but it's really thinking about what kind of a healthcare system do we want. We have a very fragmented, very specialized system that continues to pay for that kind of fragmentation and compensates very highly for high degrees of specialization. We get something from that. But if we move to a more prevention, community-oriented overall healthcare system, I think naturally the value of primary care, and I mean that in the broad sense, it increases in value and it increases relative to other things. So I think to me the question is, how much is reform really moving us to a different orientation of the healthcare system? My answer would be not as much as we need to. And if it were stronger in all respects in that kind of a vision, then I think the pieces would come together somewhat more effectively and more quickly.
And I would add to that, what we have set up in our country, frankly, is a payment system based upon procedures rather than on the cognitive value of the services that the doctor provides. That's why you really see this great disparity in incomes between physicians who are in procedurally based specialties where they do something, they cut something, or they take something out, or they have some device, versus those physicians whose information in evaluating a patient or advising a mother about a child, that's a lot of knowledge that they're bringing to bear upon that specific situation, but we don't recognize that the way we should. We don't value that. That is what's missing. We need to have more of that, and if we have more of that, we can really reduce over time our heavy reliance on repairing things. We need to prevent things. We need to engage our patients with us in really keeping themselves healthy. So we need to have a better balance and, indeed, a reform of the payment system so that those cognitive-based procedures or information really that we see in family medicine and internal medicine and pediatrics and other fields, really, they add real value. But that's not recognized in our payment system.
So this is, a great segue into the health system. You know, and the workforce is a huge part of the health system, and there are so many different pieces to the workforce part of this. But as we continue to sort of build upon that and bringing them into it, and we're starting with, you know, we could go through each piece of the system, but we're not going to. But let's just start with, you know, we're focusing on some of the medically underserved areas here and the rural areas. And what is their current situation? I guess, first of all, could somebody define for me what we say when we say medically underserved areas? What is it that makes something medically underserved? Is it just not having the doctors?
Well, the U.S. Public Health Service has definition in terms of the numbers of health professionals, the doctors, nurses, others. Also, time to get services, whether distance, et cetera. Because in my own state of Georgia, for example, Georgia is tremendously underserved when it comes to obstetrical services, where women in pregnancy have to drive an hour or more to get routine care by an obstetrician. That's not good. We know from numerous studies that women who have good prenatal care have a lower incidence of infant mortality, better maternal outcomes, and that really, again, is an investment in providing a service that'll have a good outcome. We don't want to have infants born impaired with some condition from the nervous system or what have you that could have been avoided. So really, it depends upon the criteria you're using, but what it means is not having enough access to health professionals to take care of the routine health needs of that community.
So one of the places where people do get care is public hospitals, and we talked about the community health centers, and we're going to go into those in more depth. And I'm thinking of a story that was aired earlier in the summer on 60 Minutes, where there was a clinic, an ambulatory center at a hospital that provided chemotherapy, and they ended up closing due to budget cuts because they felt it was more important to provide the trauma, which it was. They were the only regional trauma center, so. Health reform passes and everyone gets an insurance card. Do these situations no longer happen because there will be a source providing payment for health care that people are receiving?
No, they're still going to happen. And I hope the trajectory will be better. But we need to acknowledge, first of all, that we're having this discussion about very comprehensive expansions in the healthcare system while the current system is under profound strain. States are in their worst budget situation they've ever seen. Reimbursement rates, coverage rates are declining. And anything at the margin is at risk of being eliminated. And unfortunately, a lot of the things at the margin are primary and preventive. They're lower cost items that don't have as much reimbursement associated with them, don't have a funding stream that's as lucrative. And so they go. And so I think we're seeing some declines, and it's going to take a little while to pull us out. So that's the first part. Second of all, the capacity issues are on many different dimensions. And again, there are pieces throughout these the legislation before us designed to address various aspects. And I think as a package, they offer, as any piece of legislation does, some good ideas, some opportunities for improvement. The implementation timelines are in the years, which they probably need to be for much of this, given the complexity. But it's not as if we pass a law and everyone has a card and then they all have a doctor. We all know better than that, and we need to remind the American public of that because expectations, I think, are pretty high.
If I could add, I certainly would say we need to protect and preserve our public hospitals. I've seen too often around the country abandonment of our hospitals. We closed Philadelphia General Hospital, D.C. General Hospital closed. The Martin Luther King Hospital in Watts in Los Angeles closed, Milwaukee General Hospital. I'm in Atlanta. Our public hospital is Grady Hospital, has been under tremendous pressures because it has a high indigent patient population, and it's running deficits of $30, $40, $50 million every year. Fortunately, the business community in Atlanta has stepped up and said, we're going to really be sure that this hospital survives, and they are now raising $350 million to really help address the needs of that hospital. But in addition to that, Grady is working to strengthen its network of community health centers, because if we could get patients to use those community health centers for routine things rather than coming in using the emergency room at high costs, we could give care that's needed and more care at less cost. That's, again, getting back to what I was saying about we have to spend our dollars more wisely. So we need to be sure that we don't abandon our public hospitals here, because they are our safety net. And in Atlanta, the other hospitals know that if Grady Hospital disappeared, they would be overwhelmed. They could not provide the care that that hospital is providing, let alone the fact that Grady is a great training hospital. 40% of the doctors in the state of Georgia had part of their training at Grady Hospital, either as medical students or as residents, et cetera. So that's a model that we need to be sure we preserve and protect while we undergo transformation of our healthcare system. Mm-hmm.
Can I just add, we've talked up primary care, and I think appropriately so, but one of the challenges we know that community health centers face is that even when they bring folks in and are able to provide them with terrific primary care, their ability to refer out to specialty care is very limited because of all the same payment concerns. And so I think as much as we want to orient the system and we need to think about payment, part of the role that the public hospitals play is not just sort of handling things that maybe should be in the community, but also being a source for a higher level of care, which really is never going to be available at no matter how many community health centers we build.
Mm-hmm. So let's go into the community health centers. They play a critical role for people of color. About 25% of the people that they serve are people of color, rural areas, medically underserved, immigrant populations. And a recent report from the Geiger-Gibson RCHN Foundation on Community Health Collaborative has said that with the proposed changes in particularly they were focused on the HELP bill, that they're expecting about 60 million people to be accessing community health centers over the next 10 years. So the first question is, do we have enough health centers for this? You talked about capacity issues. I mean, just physical structures, do we have enough?
Well, I'm sure that in many instances we don't. Grady Hospital, that I happen to know most about since I'm now on the board of this hospital, has had to consolidate several of its community centers because of budgetary constraints. That is, part of the budget crisis from the large indigent care load has been not enough dollars for our operation. Now, also, there were other factors. A couple of these community centers had relatively few patient visits. So the question was, how do we really redistribute these centers? But clearly, we need to have a system of more readily accessible community centers so people can use them. Someone won't have to drive 3 miles or 5 miles or 10 miles to a center, and also have health professionals in that center who understand them, who speak the language, who understand the culture, et cetera. So as part of making sure that, while on the one hand, we preserve our safety net hospitals because of the trauma care and the specialty care, as well as some primary care that they give, they cannot do this alone. We need to have a strong network of community health centers. So from the generic answer to the question, no, we need to strengthen our community health centers, and we need to have our patients and our citizens understand they can get good care in these centers where they are well-staffed by doctors, nurses, and other health professionals.
Dr. Chin, you work in a community health center, and you mentioned earlier that there are provisions in the bills to have a teaching health center as part of the community health centers. What else in the bill? We talked about an increase in funding for the community health centers, and in the stimulus bill, they got an increase in funding. What more do we need in there, and are there any other provisions in the bills that speak to the community health centers?
I think... Could we use more health centers? We absolutely could use more health centers. I think the interesting thing is sometimes building physical infrastructure is easier than building human infrastructure. So when we talk about teaching health centers, it is about building the human infrastructure, the healthcare provider infrastructure in health centers. And, you know, by placing training in health centers, not only do you immediately increase the workforce in the health centers by putting residents there and the faculty that are needed to teach residents, but you also improve recruitment, you improve retention of existing faculty, you create a pool to recruit from. So the teaching health centers is obviously a very important factor there. I think there are other things. There are things like the expansion of National Health Service Corps. And in the health side, they've created a health care workforce needs area, something like that. So it's not a health professional shortage area, it's a health professional needs area, and creating, as Dr. Sullivan was talking about, more loan repayment in this sense, but to get people into these areas. And so there are some other provisions. I think the feeling is that there could always be more. And when we're looking at going from the current patient population of community health centers being about 15 million, and if we're going to 60 million, we need a lot more, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's a start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would just add quickly the idea of a teaching community health center. That's important. That is, you cannot train physicians or other health professionals in high-intensity, large urban centers and then expect them to go out to community centers. Community centers, they can learn there. They learn how medicine is practiced and what the issues are, and they become comfortable there. In the same way that a number of training programs have rural sites for training as well, so that the students will learn what that community is like. Those programs have been successful in getting new professionals to establish their practices in those areas because they have had some experience. So the community, so the teaching community health center would have that advantage as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, Alan, in all of this, what are the state's biggest concerns going forward?
Well, there's a... In all of health reform?
Right. Or, well, you know, when we're talking about workforce issues in the community center.
I think you began by noting that the outlines of the legislation include a major expansion of the Medicaid program. There's been a lot of talk about the financing implications for states that I don't need to go into, but I think there's a lot less attention to the delivery side implications. What does it mean, just as you talk about quadrupling potentially the number of people going to health centers, what does it mean to radically expand the size of your program? It's growing now because of the economic downturn, but we're talking about yet another on top of it. We're talking about straining administrative systems. We're talking about programs that already feel like they struggle to hold on to sufficient number of doctors and other providers to make sure that having a Medicaid card really turns into access in some areas where needs are very poorly met, such as in oral health and mental health. And the notion that we're now going to add a promise of coverage to a whole new group of people who clearly need it, but are we really going to be able to provide the services? So I think on the state side, again, moving away from just the pure financial issues, is the question of, are we going to make a promise to people that through these reforms we're giving you something that, in fact, we're going to have a very hard time achieving? Let me flip to the other side, which is there are these expansions in private coverage through subsidies and state or federally administered exchanges or mm-hmm. whatever you want to mm-hmm. call them. Or however, whatever shape they end up being in. Again, are states going to be able to assure by the regulation and oversight of these various entities and all the plans they contract with meaningful access to care, receive and analyze the data provided by these health plans to be sure that people really are getting care? Monitoring the kinds of disparities in access and outcomes that we see today to determine whether or not any of these are improving. Because I think that the biggest, I mean, there are many fears about health reform and many hopes about it. But of course, the biggest disappointment would be to say, look at all of these wonderful things we've done, but then as it turns out, we just don't have anything behind that first layer of coverage to really improve health care.
And you mentioned Medicaid, and you know you were quoted in an article on Sunday in the Washington Post that talked about some of the state challenges and the variation that we might see, because there is a lot of flexibility at the state level. So first, could you, just for those who might not have seen the article, talk a little bit about what is the state flexibility in here, and particularly, as you mentioned, with regards to kind of the Medicaid program going forward?
So I could go very broad and say that under, again, so much about health reform has not taken shape, but states under current law define many aspects of the Medicaid program. Now, eligibility levels would be increased under the federal statutes, but how you deliver care, your reliance on managed care versus fee-for-service, limitations on coverage of how many prescriptions you can have filled, what your payment levels are to providers, which has a huge effect on access and whether you have a broad panel or narrower ones. And if you look more broadly, the regulation of insurance and how aggressively, if states are negotiating with plans, are they how aggressive are states going to be on demanding access, demanding outcomes? There are many new opportunities for waivers and plan modifications working with Medicare, integrating Medicaid and Medicare, which is our most vulnerable population. We don't know how those will play out, but again, they'll very much depend on the opportunities and how states take advantage of the opportunities. I guess it's a long way of saying there are many great things states could do with the tools in reform, but not all states will take them up equally. And just as we have tremendous variation around the country now on all kinds of health indicators, I don't think we should pretend that the reform being discussed is going to eliminate those. Hopefully, some of the larger disparities will be narrowed because we'll be bringing up the floor of coverage in Medicaid, which will make a huge difference, because we'll be reducing the differences across states in the number of uninsured, where the gaps are tremendous. It won't be closed entirely, but it will be narrower. But on the ground, where people interact with social systems, educational systems, and health systems, where they interact with grocery stores or sidewalks or not, or sit and watch television and or all of those kinds of things, and then go to the doctor or not, or find the care they need or not, or are part of an integrated system that really looks at them holistically, or are just seeing one doctor at a time, those differences don't go away in health reform.
So very quickly, because we are sort of running out of time, and I wanted to go in a little bit further, but we've talked about telehealth and telemedicine and electronic records, and this is big. I mean, there was a lot of money in the stimulus for that, and there are some provisions that speak to HIT in the health reform bills. But with regards to its usage, particularly sort of in the rural areas or some of the other areas to help connect providers, what is the current status of telemedicine? How often is it used, and to what extent?
Well, it really is still needs to be used a lot more. That is, it is not widely used, but it's very promising. But these things take time. Interestingly enough, in 1990, when I was secretary, I formed what was then called the Working Group on Electronic Data Interchange, which preceded the HIPAA legislation in 1994. And we've built towards this. We have the technical capability of these networks, but they're expensive. We need to be sure that they are put in place, and we need to train our health professionals to use them. Fortunately, health professionals who are being trained now, today's nursing students, medical students, and other health profession students, this is part of their world. But among physicians, older physicians, say 50 and older, say physicians of my era, really a lot of them are not using this, both because of the expense as well as the fact that they're not familiar, not comfortable with them. That will change. But I think this underlines one of the issues about health reform in general that I would say. Whatever bill Congress passes, and I have urged that there be legislative action, it's not going to be the final answer. This will be the beginning. You touched on the lead time in terms of manpower, and you're absolutely right. We're talking about physicians, nurses, dentists, other health professionals, public health workers, et cetera. It takes time to develop those professionals. So we have to be prepared for the beginning of this process, but knowing that we're going to have to do a lot more as a country to really get our health system in order. It's not going to be one bill. It's not going to be overnight. But we have to start because we're spending $2.4 trillion every year now from public and private sources. In 1989, 20 years ago, when I became secretary, we were spending $1 trillion. So we have more than doubled that amount. So if we don't act now, we're going to postpone this. Our citizens will not have the health services they need. The costs are going to go up. The dysfunctions in the system are going to become even worse. So we really have to have the political will and the collegiality of our elected leaders to really work together to solve this problem. All of these things are going to take time, but we have to begin.
So time. What is the time? I mean, we're sort of talking, and I think, we had a recent poll where the foundation did, and it looked at people's expectations. And about half of the people polled expect that, we're going to see immediate action. What is the realistic timeline that we should be telling people to expect with regards to passage of health reform? And we'll just narrow it to this focus of the conversation on the healthcare system and workforce. what is the timeline that we could expect to see these changes take place?
Well, I'll begin by saying this. The first issue is going to be really addressing health insurance. That is something that can really happen with a greater degree of rapidity. That is important, and we have to indeed see that people do have health insurance. But again, as Massachusetts' example has shown, that doesn't solve all the problems. We have to have the manpower. We have to really find ways to get our patient, improve the health behavior of our population. So all of these things are part of this. But the point is, we have to work together. Realize we have tremendous problems, but we have the solutions too. But we have to really put our shoulder to the wheel and work to get these solutions. It's like building a house. You can't build a house in a day. You know, it takes a year or so or longer. But you have to begin. Dig out the ground, put in the foundation, put up the frame, et cetera. So the same with the healthcare system. But we have not acted, and that delay is costing us as a nation. So we have to get started. But again, try and be realistic with the public, saying that we aren't going to solve this overnight, but we have to get started on it.
I'm sure it's not wise to estimate when the debate will end, given that people will look back, and I will assuredly be wrong. But assuming we can reach some closure on this over the next few months, most of the coverage provisions, which we would think of as potentially the easier ones to implement, don't take effect until 2013 or 2014. Now, that will be here faster than we know, but if you don't have health insurance today, that doesn't seem very soon. And then to the extent that those provisions are impetus for broader kinds of shifts in the system, those will take time. Although I do think one of the surprising and wonderful things about the American healthcare system, as with the American economy in general, is how quickly it can turn when there's a clear sense of where it needs to turn. And we move out of a debating mode and into a, well, this is our new world, organizations all over the country will be sitting and thinking, what does this mean for my future? How do we need to rethink how we organize, practice, market, whatever it is? And it's amazing how nimble in the end our system can be. And if you're in the middle of it, it doesn't look so fast. But I think we will see some of the responses happening even before the coverage provisions are put in place as organizations are positioning themselves for a new era.
I think we all hesitate to try to predict the timeline of healthcare reform and when it's going to pass. But one of the things that I do think is that if healthcare reform passes and we get coverage, there's two ways that we could go. We could go in sort of the Massachusetts way, where once our people start to realize that coverage doesn't equal access, and we need to start building our health center infrastructure, we need to start building our healthcare workforce infrastructure, and we can react at that point. Or we can put this step forward and immediately start to take the next steps. And I think it is pretty clear that primary care needs to be strengthened and that our system needs to be more primary care focused in order to improve quality and to achieve the cost savings and to keep people out of the hospital and the emergency rooms because they don't need to be there. And that is really the best thing for our healthcare system and for the nation. I think, you know, it could go one of two ways, is that if we get the healthcare reform passed and we get coverage, then we wait and we react, or we start down the path right now. And unfortunately, this set isn't changing the paradigm. It's taking a good step, but it's not changing the paradigm. And what we need to do is we really do need to change the paradigm of our healthcare system.
I want to make sure we're not too negative in our use of Massachusetts as an example. It's not as if Massachusetts alone had a primary care shortage. It's just that when everyone had a card, it was more visible. And I think, although I completely agree that we need to build for the future and not just go and then react, there are some things that we just don't react to very well until they are right in front of us. And there are issues that we won't address as a nation until we deal with having tens of millions of people without health insurance. And so I would hope we view these as a pair, and I would hope that we take the Massachusetts as a lesson learned about capacity, but not as sort of a sense of, boy, they got it wrong, because I don't think that's what either of you meant, but I wanted to clear.
No, I would agree. Certainly, clearly, we shouldn't leave our listeners with the idea that we have nothing but problems. We really have well-trained health professionals. We have the strongest biomedical research enterprise of any nation in the world, that developing new discoveries. And from that standpoint, never has it been more exciting than what's coming out of our laboratories and out of clinical studies, et cetera. And we have a strong educational system, but the capacity needs to be ramped up. That's what will take the time. So we really need to work to address those deficiencies in the system, which include manpower, include insurance and access to care, and includes our community network of community health centers, preserving our safety net hospitals, and learning, and also having our citizens work with us. They have to be part of the solution in really those things to keep well. You know, right now we're having trouble getting mothers taking their children for vaccination because of misinformation about autism, where there's not one bit of scientific evidence to suggest that autism is a result of the preservatives in vaccines. So we need to do a better job of educating our citizens and have them really exercise regularly, have the right diet and other things. So it really is having a system that works, but also having an involved, educated citizenry for health promotion, disease prevention. All of this can come together. It take time, but no, we have a lot to be thankful for. So it's not certainly, we're talking about focusing on those deficiencies, but there's a lot out there that's very positive.
I think that is a great way to end, and I think that this is obviously a step in the right direction in terms of if we can get health reform passed, and there are a lot of things in the bills that would be helpful in terms of improving the workforce capacity and addressing some of the needs of these populations, but we still have much more to see and much more to come, and I think that's an important message to leave people with, that this is not, we pass health reform and we dust our hands off and say good job and we're done, but that there is still more to come, and that, you know, it's going to take time and we'll continue effort. So there's a lot that we could continue covering, but we only have an hour. So before we close, I would like to thank Dr. Sullivan, Dr. Chen, and Alan Weil for joining me today. And I would like to thank all of you for your questions. On our webpage, you will find resources on today's topic that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Kara James of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.